Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Nelson versus Miller. Mr. Mills.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Mr. Nelson is right here. Chaplain Miller is wrong. This case goes to the core of the First Amendment, both the free exercise and the establishment clauses. I guess on a personal level, I became hooked on this case when I saw the grievances and saw a discussion of what Jesus and God's word was, a debate over biblical citations, and whether a cenobite monks could be in place at Tams. It's the kind of discussion I thought the First Amendment was prohibited, or did prohibit, a state official having that kind of a discussion with a prisoner, conditioning a benefit, a vegan diet that he wanted. It was driven home to me when I went to the deposition of Mr. Nelson. It's held in the bowels of Tams. He's sitting there shackled, his hands, he can't take notes. His feet are shackled, he can't walk, he's chained to a concrete stump, and you have the representatives of the Illinois Attorney General, the highest law enforcement officer in the state, cross-examining him about the beliefs of St. Benedict in the 800s, St. Stephen's, etc. I always thought that's what the First Amendment was supposed to prohibit, is that kind of cross-examination by a state official. And here we end up with a federal trial on exactly those issues, what his personal beliefs are, and having to justify them in a court of law. The district court denied Mr. Nelson relief primarily on the substantial burden issue. The district court did not have the advantage of this court's decision in Crozier, which came out a couple of days after my window for asking for reconsideration closed. So we ended up here. Despite this court's opinion in Crozier and a couple of other district court opinions, the regulation remains in effect in the state of Illinois, requiring that it be a requirement of one's religion to get a vegan diet or a religious diet accommodation, and requiring authorization by an outside religious authority figure, despite this court's rulings. That regulation has not been changed, and it continues to be enforced. And Chaplain Miller at trial in this case said, if we're up to him, he would not give my client his religious diet even today, because that regulation remains in force, and in his personal opinion, neither the law nor the Constitution matter. All that matters is what the warden tells him to do and what the institutional directive at TAM says. I think that Crozier pretty much dealt with the substantial burden issue, which brings us to several issues about whether or not we can get relief, particularly under RLUIPA. The defendant's position is that all relief is closed to us, that our claim for injunctive relief is mooted by the fact that at the last minute, they, under coercion, defendant changed his mind and approved the religious diet, therefore we can't get injunctive relief. They say that damages are not available against him individually because it's under the Commerce Clause rather than the 14th Amendment, and therefore there is no liability for individuals, and that the state also is immune from damages. So any state official in the country can now avoid RLUIPA entirely by simply on the eve of trial saying, well, we're going to give you your diet after all. And then they would never have to comply with RLUIPA at all because each of those cases would be moot and no damages were available, so they could go on their merry way and completely ignore the statute. I don't think that's what Congress intended, and I don't think that's what the case law or the language of the statute require. I'll turn first to the question of whether or not the state, as a state, can be liable for damages under RLUIPA. There's now a clear split in the authorities in the circuits. The 11th Circuit in Benning said that there was a waiver. The 4th and 5th Circuit, the 5th Circuit being brought to the attention in a Rule 28 letter, in Sosman and 4th Circuit in Madison say there is not a waiver in RLUIPA. Everybody agrees, I think, that Congress intended there to be a damages remedy under RLUIPA. The Supreme Court seems to have quite firmly held that when Congress uses a phrase like all appropriate relief, it includes a damages award unless there's something specific in the statute which precludes damages, and in this case there clearly is not. So the question really is whether or not Congress can constitutionally impose a damages remedy against the state.
Well, as you point out, the statute doesn't mention monetary damages. It just says appropriate relief. Don't we need unambiguous language to find that the state agreed to waive its immunity to monetary damages?
Well, that's the question. That is certainly the way that the Fourth and now the Fifth Circuit have held. I think, though, that the problem with that argument is that The Supreme Court has said everybody should know that when Congress uses the words all appropriate relief, it includes damages. So what the Fourth and Fifth Circuits have said is, well, everybody in the world may be on notice of that, but we're going to pretend the states are not on notice of that. That the states aren't aware of the Supreme Court, long line of Supreme Court cases that says, when it uses that general phrase, all appropriate relief, it includes damages. And therefore, when states take the money, they aren't really aware that they might be liable for damages. There's clearly another line of cases, which now culminated in Madison, which says that it has to be in the text of the statute. Frankly, I don't see anything in the Constitution that requires that textual, that it be in the text itself. If we use interpretive tools all the time, that's what courts do. It's well established that the legislature is supposed to understand the way courts interpret statutes when they enact them, and that the well-established rules of statutory interpretation should be taken into account when you determine what a legislature intended. It's our contention that the same rules should apply to state legislators and state executives, that when they read these statutes, including RLUIPA, they should be well aware of the long line of United States Supreme Court cases saying that all appropriate relief includes damages. And therefore, when they voluntarily agree to take federal money, they are also aware that they have bought into that long line of cases saying damages are awarded.
Do we have a situation here where federal funds are involved?
Yes. The Supreme Court held in, I believe it was the Cutter case, every state has now taken federal funds for their prison systems.
For their prison system?
For the prison system, right. And
has it been specifically identified in this case?
No, it has not. It was not an issue in the trial court and hasn't been made an issue in this court. I think everybody agreed that they took federal money for the prison system, and Wilkinson clearly said that taking it just for the prison system is enough. It doesn't have to be for a particular, like for the religious portion of the
So we'll have Ms. Murphy acknowledging that, you suspect?
I do suspect that, yes.
No one's asked that question before?
No one has ever asked that question before. And
would it be a predicate in this case?
It would certainly be a defense in this case. I don't think it's part of our cause of action, given that nobody denied that RLUIPA applied, and given the Supreme Court's clear statement that every state had accepted federal money. If they had said no, then we would have, of course, brought in some evidence on it, but I don't think there's anybody who ever doubts that federal money was taken. Certainly, if they hadn't, then they would have raised that as our whole waiver argument goes out the window. If there was no agreement at all to accept RLUIPA funds, then and actually they conceded in the brief that injunctive relief is available if it wasn't moot, and that wouldn't be true either if they didn't take any federal money. So yes, I think they've actually conceded it in this court by conceding that some injunctive relief is necessary or appropriate.
What about Kroger's requirement of verification, Mr. Mills? What's the parameters, or how would you cabin that inquiry, the legitimacy or the sweep of that inquiry?
I think that what Kroger says is that there cannot be such a requirement, period. That if a prisoner sincerely believes something, which they've stipulated in this case that he does, then that's the end of the inquiry.
So there need not be a verification by any member of a clergy of the prescribed faith, or?
I don't think that you can ever require that, because that RLUIPA says it doesn't have to be a requirement of the faith. I think that sometimes such an inquiry would be relevant if you are trying to determine whether or not the prisoner is sincere in his beliefs, or if he's just manipulating the system.
Well, if one has, non-mainline belief, if you and I can fairly use that expression.
As in Kroger itself.
Yeah, and indeed it's apparently new, let's say, on the horizon, religious horizon. Would you allow that a clergy person could attend the verification of that faith, or make some scholarly inquiry?
They could certainly make some inquiry. The question is, what's the purpose of the inquiry? If the purpose of the inquiry is to determine that this is actually a religious-based belief and that it's sincere, then I think that's appropriate. But to say that the purpose of the inquiry, which is what happened here, is not sincerity, but to make sure it's actually a requirement of that religion, that is prohibited by the terms of RLUIPA itself.
So the prisoner could be mistaken, but if he sincerely believes that chocolate sundaes on Thursday nights are are a commitment of the faith, that still would be not to be questioned if it's a sincerely held belief.
Well, I disagree with your premise, but I agree with your conclusion. That is, I think the whole point is you can't be mistaken about your beliefs. If it's a sincere religious belief, it's a belief. It's not a mistake at all. It's what you believe. And I think that's the very point, is the courts...
What if you're in a position where you believe that being held in custody is against it, and that all force within you compels you, or the faith within you compels you to resist to the extent that you cause what we could agree is a disruption in the system? What about that? And that it sincerely held.
Well, but RLUIPA doesn't say you have to accommodate all sincerely religious held beliefs. It says that then the burden shifts to the state. And every court that's looked at this has said that security is clearly a legitimate issue that the defendants can use to not provide any kind of religious accommodation. That obviously is not a case here. All we're asking for is the exact same vegan diet that was served to dozens and dozens of men
every
day. Well,
that's why, as wild as my hypothetical might seem to you, suppose it goes out outside the parameters of the vegan diet, which understandably is followed by both religious and non-religious
right.
people. What if it becomes a little more esoteric? I don't know if it rises to, quote, security concerns, but just operational concerns.
That's where most of the litigation around this issue has arisen, is where does that security kick in? And I mean, there have been many cases about people who wanted, for example, oils or candles or those kinds of things, and depending on the proof that's presented, those can certainly be legitimate issues. If there's a history of fires and they have a lot of paper, then you can well say candles are not allowed, period. It has nothing to do with religion. We're just, for security reasons, we can't allow candles. And certainly somebody who believes that they should resist authority, and there are certainly such people, and we have a long history of civil disobedience in this country, and the Swords to Plowshares movement, for example, certainly believes that and they're Catholic based, so they're relevant to this case, certainly believes that locking people in jail is wrong and that resisting authority is right. But nonetheless, nobody would say that as a result of that, therefore, you have to let them out of jail or that you have to let them resist authority.
In this case, we have, let's assume for purpose of argument, a reasonable request, because vegan diets are regularly provided
right.
in other settings. So would you suggest, because it falls into relatively easy to comply with the request, that sincerity can't be inquired of?
No, not at all. It's a two-step process. Clearly, the prisoner has the first burden of showing both that it's sincere and that there's a substantial burden on it. Once they meet that test, then that's not the end of the case. That only shifts the burden to the state then to show that there's a good state reason.
I just want to follow how we get there.
Right.
So one makes the statement, as is made in our case. What should it just be accepted because it so easily falls within a matter that can be accommodated, so we don't get to sincerity?
No, I think that, again, and that's what chaplains do every day, and in fact we have some evidence of that in this case. I asked, I think it was Father Fortenberry at trial, is part of your job as a Catholic priest to determine sincerity of parishioners? And he said, of course, that's what I do every day. Somebody comes in and makes a confession. Under my belief system, and before I can give absolution to that, I have to determine that he's sincere in his confession. And that's the kind of skills that I have. And therefore, it's perfectly appropriate for a chaplain to make determinations about sincerity and to make determinations about what is and isn't religious, although that is becoming very tricky, particularly in this circuit where they've said that atheism is a religion now. So I'm not quite sure where the line is between religion and non-religion. And frankly, if I were running the prison system, I would simply say if you have a sincere belief that you ought to have a vegan diet, you should give it to them. But I don't, and that's not what the law says.
Well, can't the chaplain require that there be some religious tenet supporting the dietary request?
Well, yes, but I guess my question is exactly what you mean by religious tenets. You can certainly require that the prisoner have some religious beliefs that support his request. As to whether you can require that this be a religious belief that's confirmed by some written document from the outside, no, I do not think you can require that.
So you're saying that it can't be verified. The belief is enough. Just because I'm concerned about the sort of parameters, as Judge Flom is. I mean, you can't. So there's no requirement that it be tied to any tenet or belief system or proposition in the faith itself.
I think that's right. I think that somebody who made up his own religion and it had all the indicia of religion that we think about, and nobody but him in the world believed it, if it's a sincerely held and it qualifies as a religious belief, then it's entitled to deference under RLUIPA.
Well, then how does somebody determine whether it qualifies as a religious belief? Yeah. I mean, that's where the rubber hits the road. That is
correct, and that's a very difficult question. I mean, the things the courts have looked at is religion means it has an sort of overarching hierarchy of ethical values that apply to the entire world or your conduct in the world, and has some sort of a authority figure or, in the atheism case, lack thereof, as being the two sort of criteria you look at as to whether it's religious as compared to ethical. I don't know where that line is. I mean, I think it's a very difficult line. But Congress has required us to draw
it. We need a following up on Judge Williams' question. Then do we really need a clergy person to do the verifying? Do we need, I don't know what type of person would qualify then to be the interpreter of insincerity. I suspect everybody in the prison system at one time or another in regard to a request for medical aid or has to make a read on the request. So in this setting you posit, who should be that filter on sincerity, or judge, if you will, on sincerity?
Well, chaplains make sense because they are the ones that best able to judge whether something is in fact religious. I mean, if anybody in the prison system has that knowledge, it's presumably someone who's religiously trained. And as Chaplain Miller says in his testimony here, he wasn't trained just in the Lutheran doctrine, but when he went through theology school, he studied a wide variety of doctrines. That doesn't mean he's intimately familiar with them, but presumably he has a good concept and has thought through the idea of what religion is. It's something that a warden, for example, may never have thought about in his life, whereas hopefully a chaplain has given that some rather deep thought as to what is a religion and what isn't a religious. What does a religious belief mean? Congress has required us, or required prison officials, to make that determination, and it's certainly not unreasonable to delegate that decision-making to a chaplain. That's their profession. So I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to do.
I have an interest in something much more dull than this, though. Exhaustion.
Yes.
Your client didn't assert that he would just take a vegan diet every day until after the suit started, did he?
Well, that's not quite true. No, what he said was his original grievance, the one the United States focuses on in their amicus, and we started
with. Was meatless Fridays.
Meatless Fridays and meatless Lent.
And meatless Lent.
But he was quickly told, when he made that sort of oral request, he was immediately told, well, you can't do that at TAMS. If you want that, then you've just got to have a vegan diet, period. So in his very first request, written request, he said, this is what I want, but I understand this is what that security won't let me do it that way, and therefore I'm willing to take a vegan diet all the time. And he continued to say that in each and every grievance he filed, that what I really want is this, but I know you can't get that at TAMS, so what I want that you have available is a vegan diet all the time.
But he initially justified that under the Cenobite principles, I think you contend he grieved that. But then subsequent to that, he said, well, just on my religious principles, I'll take a vegan diet all the time.
Well, no. Originally, he said, his faith clearly evolved. I mean, what he started off with was a question in his own mind, which is why when I was in grade school at St. Benedict's Elementary School, did we have no fish on Fridays, or did we have only fish on Fridays? And then all of a sudden, we didn't. So he went back and tried to figure that out in his own mind and did some studying, did some reading, and learned all about penances and the Pope's dispensation, applying only to the United States, not to the rest of the world, that you don't have to abstain from meat on Fridays, and then found the rule of St. Benedict and continued on. But from the very beginning, when all he wanted was the traditional no meat on Lent and no meatless Fridays, he said, I understand, though, because of my discussions with security people, that you're not going to do that. Therefore, I want the diet that you give us, which is the vegan diet all the time. That's what I'll take that you offer, among the menu of choices you offer. The second choice he made was the one based on the rule of St. Benedict, as he read it initially, which said no meat anytime from four-footed animals. And that's the final, and again, he said, but again, I understand you can't do that because all you give it, the only option we have at TAMS is a vegan diet, which is what they give everybody who wants any religious accommodation. So he said, well, I'll take that one since that's all you've got. It is true that later on, after he exhausted that and after he filed suit, he said his beliefs continued to evolve and say, well, what I would really think I ought to do is have a vegan diet all the time. But his request...
Did he exhaust that?
Well, did he ever put that last belief in the grievance? No. Well, he did not exhaust in a grievance that he exhausted. No. He did not put that belief in there. But as I said, from the very beginning, what he requested and what he was complaining about was that they refused to give him a vegan diet. If they had offered a choice between meatless Fridays and Lent and meatless Lent, and choice two is vegan diet and choice three is meatless diet, is a regular meat diet, then they might have had an argument that he had an exhaust. But since that middle ground was never an option at TAMS, his only option was the regular diet all the time or the vegan diet all the time. And what he grieved was that he was denied the vegan diet all the time because that's the only option he had. Then he exhausted that. And that's all he had to do under this court's decisions.
Does it matter that his justification for the vegan diet evolved beyond what he had grieved?
I think that this court's rulings clearly say no, it did not. That you don't, at least at the time. At the time, it was a notice pleading standard in grievances. Therefore, he had no obligation to explain the basis for it at all. All he had to say was, I have a religious belief. You didn't give me the vegan diet. End of grievance. He, in fact, cited the rule of St. Benedict and his beliefs and got into a religious dispute with the chaplain as to exactly which provisions in the Bible were correct penances and which were wrong. So he went way further than he had to. But all this court required in the Strong case is notice pleading, that you give them fair notice of what you're complaining about. And in this case, what he was complaining about is that Chaplain Miller wasn't recognizing his religious beliefs, which required a vegan diet all the time, because that's all that TAMS offered. They might have a good argument if they'd given in-between diets, and therefore he had shifted what he wanted. But they never offered that option. And therefore, what he was complaining about is, I didn't get the vegan diet I wanted.
I just wanted to shift back for a minute to the injunctive release question, just so I can be clear. Is it your view that Chaplain Miller has authority to withdraw the vegan diet at this point?
Yes. The answer is I don't know. What he said was, I gave it because I was directed to do so by the warden. That warden is no longer at TAMS. So whether has that authority or not is entirely dependent on a non-defendant in this case, the warden. What we do know is that he testified that he would, given the option, withdraw it, and that the regulations which he believes require him to withdraw it remain in place. So this is very different than, example, the Sulzman case, which they gave you in the Rule 28, where they had actually changed the underlying regulations, and the head of the department had put an affidavit saying, this has been fixed, and we're no longer requiring this. So in this case, you have the defendant saying, but for the fact that somebody else gave me a specific order in this individual case to give him the diet, he wouldn't have it today. And I continue to believe that I should be enforcing that regulation no matter what the courts say, no matter what the statute says. I should be enforcing this rule that says I have to have verification from an outside person. So he's continued to say that today. He has never come in with an affidavit saying I'll never give it to him. The warden has never come in and testified at all that he's never going to change his mind. We have no statements as to what the current warden thinks at all. For all we know, as soon as this case disappears, then he's off the diet, and that they've only done this in order to moot the case. And I think that the law is clear that they have the burden of showing that there's no likelihood of recurring here. And given the testimony that is in the record here, the sworn testimony of Chaplain Miller, that if it was up to me, I would take his diet away immediately, then I don't think that they have a good argument that it's moot.
So your fear is that the chaplain might lobby a successor warden, and that therefore we shouldn't consider it moot?
I don't think he has to lobby the successor warden. My fear is that a successor warden wouldn't even care. I mean, it takes an affirmative action by a successor warden saying, directing him to violate the existing regulations. And even if we had an affidavit from a warden saying, I'm going to continue to order him to violate the existing regulations, as long as the regulations are in place and they haven't changed them, then at the whim of anybody, they can go back to enforcing them.
Well, how representative is Mr. Nelson? In other words, if his demand has been satisfied, what would be the sweep of the injunctive relief, Mr. Mills? Would it speak only to Mr. Nelson?
It could certainly be narrowly drawn that way. I think the injunction should be narrowly drawn that way. I think, however, the declaratory judgment should be what this court held in Coger, which is that the regulation as it's currently written violates RLUIPA. And with that, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Ms. Murphy.
May it please the Court, Rachel Murphy, Assistant Illinois Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the defendant appellee, Chaplain Miller. I'd like to start by recharacterizing what this case is about. Mr. Mills has said that this is about whether Mr. Nelson's belief was religious and was sincere. That's not what this case is about. We have conceded that Mr. Nelson had a sincere religious belief, and what this case is about is whether Mr. Nelson can get damages for the denial of a vegan diet during a certain time period during which he believed he could not eat the meat of four-legged animals. We think that he cannot get damages, first of all, because he cannot get damages against Mr. Miller in his official capacity because sovereign immunity has not been waived. Also, there's no individual capacity suit authorized under RLUIPA. And the district court did not clearly err in finding, as a matter of fact, that Mr. Nelson's practice was not substantially burdened, nor did the court err in limiting the relevant claim to the belief in four-legged animal meat because there was no exhaustion about avoiding all meat. I wanted to start with the legal limitations on Mr. Nelson's relief. First, as to the mootness question, if you look at the transcript, page 113, when asked, Chaplain Miller stated he cannot go against the authority of the warden. It is not his decision whether to withdraw this diet. The fact is, once Mr. Nelson stated in a written request that he believed he could not eat any meat, he was given the vegan diet, and he continues to receive the vegan diet today. Although Chaplain Miller may have personal misgivings about that, he is not the authority that makes that decision.
And so what's to ensure that the warden won't change his mind or and side with the chaplain's view?
Your Honor, we fully follow the Coger decision, and we have advised all the chaplains in the system that when a prisoner has a sincere belief that is religiously based, that requires a vegan diet or that necessitates a vegan diet, that diet is to be given to that inmate. Now, the regulation hasn't been changed. Unfortunately, the wheels grind very slowly. But we are in full compliance and intend to be in full compliance with the Coger decision. And our chaplains understand that this kind of a back-and-forth colloquy about what a religion requires is not appropriate.
Yeah, and so you're saying that that's in the works, that new directive is in the works.
Yes.
And so is that the reason why, I mean, this case, I mean, if his simple request had just been met, so much time and effort and money would have been saved. Anyway, it's good to hear that the regulation is in the works, so we hopefully wouldn't have this kind of scenario happen again.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, there's no evidence that Mr. Nelson's vegan diet is going to be withdrawn. So that injunctive claim is moot. What he's left with then is damages. And as the Fourth and the Fifth and the D.C. circuits have all held, the appropriate relief against a government language does not expressly authorize damages against a sovereign. It is too open-ended and ambiguous. The Supreme Court has rejected the kind of reasoning that the 11th Circuit employed, which Mr. Mills repeated here, which is the presumption that when remedies are not explicitly stated, you would presume that money damages are included. But in the Lane case, the Supreme Court said when you are dealing with a sovereign, the remedies are not those that are appropriate, but only those that are expressly waived. So the Supreme Court has conclusively foreclosed that line of reasoning. And what we're left with, again, is looking at whether in the text there is an expression of waiver for money damages, and that is absent. In his reply brief, Mr. Nelson raised a cross-reference to the PLRA damages limitations, and he cited the West case. But the PLRA is very different from the compensatory damages amendment that is cross-referenced in Title VII. The compensatory damages amendment affirmatively authorizes damages for Title VII actions. But the PLRA is simply a procedural overlay that limits damages. It does not provide a substantive right to damages for all prisoner litigation. So that's not a relevant analogy. RLUIPA also does not authorize a claim against Mr. Miller in his individual capacity. Mr. Mills didn't address this point, but just quickly, the authority is only on one side on this issue. Both the Fifth and Eleventh Circuits have held that the spending clause does not encompass liability for non-fund recipients.
Is there language in RLUIPA defining government to include any other person acting under color of state law?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
So doesn't the chaplain fall under that?
He does fall under that. And this court in Mack versus O'Leary stated that that kind of under color of law language would appear to allow for an individual action. The problem is that RLUIPA, unlike RFRA, was passed under the spending clause. And Congress's spending clause authority is limited. It's limited to reach the recipient of the federal funds under a kind of contract understanding. So even if there is an interpretation of the language that would reach Chaplain Miller, the court should avoid an interpretation that raises constitutional questions, which extending RLUIPA to Chaplain Miller in his individual capacity would do.
Of course, if we go too far with that contract analogy, then Chaplain is sort of a third-party beneficiary of that because of the funds that come to the prison that help employ various staff and so on.
Well, the chaplain's not really a third-party beneficiary the way that the Supreme Court has looked at it. In the Barnes case, which Mr. Nelson cited in his reply, the Supreme Court said individuals who are aggrieved under a spending clause legislation can receive the benefit of a cause of action against the funding recipient. But the court stated that the contract analogy means when remedies aren't delineated, you look at what was traditionally available for a breach of contract action. And Mr. Nelson raises the idea of a tortious interference kind of claim. But that is not a contract-based claim. That's a tort-based claim. And the Supreme Court said in Barnes that appropriate remedies means those that are traditionally available for the breach of contract, not punitive damages, and, by analogy, not a tortious interference kind of remedy.
Well, then what about 1983, First Amendment claim against Miller?
The section...
If RLUIPA bars individual action against him, why not claim under 1983?
That's right. He does have a claim under Section 1983 under the First Amendment. He raised the Fitzgerald case, but we don't contest that. He definitely has a separate claim under Section 1983. He has not brought any kind of Section 1983 RLUIPA statutory claim. That was never brought, so that's not relevant here. So even if there's no individual action under RLUIPA, that's right. His First Amendment claim would still survive. But turning to that claim, turning to the free exercise, the court properly narrowed the claims here to those based on the belief in not eating the meat of four-legged animals. It would be strange to extend the grievances that were filed before he had a belief to cover harm that never occurred to a belief that he didn't have at the time he filed his grievances.
So you're contending this evolving basis, the conclusion of that was not exhausted?
Yes, that's right. He admits he did not file any grievance after his belief evolved to include no meat. And in fact, when he wrote a request and stated, "My belief is I can't eat any meat," he was given the diet. He was given the vegan diet at that time. So he didn't give officials any opportunity through the grievance process to give him the vegan diet or to determine if he should have the vegan diet after his belief had evolved to the point where the regular diet would have been a substantial burden. We don't contest that. If his belief was he couldn't eat meat, he can't just get the regular diet and meet that belief.
And when he made that decision and made that request, where was the litigation? Was that pre this litigation?
No, Your Honor.
This was after the litigation.
That's right. It was the litigation was originally filed in February of 2003. Then in May of 2005, after the magistrate judge had entered a recommendation to deny the preliminary injunction, Mr. Nelson filed a supplemental affidavit stating, "No, the court got my belief wrong. My belief now is I can't eat any meat." Then in April...
And so that was the first time that was articulated. That's what I'm trying to pinpoint time-wise.
Okay. Yes. That is the first time that we became aware that his belief had evolved. Indeed, even up in his first response to the magistrate's judge's recommendation, he still was characterizing his belief as that of avoiding four-legged animals. So then in April of 2006, he filed the written request based on this new belief and was given the diet. So there wasn't any point at which officials were made aware that he believed he couldn't eat meat, denied him a diet based on that belief, and he grieved that denial. And to stretch the May and September 2002 grievances to cover his new belief goes beyond notice pleading. I mean, the timing, first of all, is impossible. You can't grieve something that hasn't happened. And it's the belief that's key to the nature of the harm done to him. Because when he was getting the regular diet and believed he couldn't eat the meat of four-legged animals, the regular diet didn't pose a substantial burden to his belief. But once he believed he couldn't eat any meat, we agree that that's when he was entitled to get the vegan diet. So looking at the substantial burden, the court properly limited the claim to the four-legged animal meat and didn't clearly err in finding after a bench trial that as a matter of fact, Mr. Nelson's belief was not substantially burdened because he could simply eat around the beef that he was occasionally served in the meals.
That's the Friday and Lent issue?
No, this is the four-legged meat issue, which is the claim that was articulated to the district court and was the focus of the trial. The Friday and Lent issue is something that was raised by amicus and hasn't been articulated by Mr. Nelson himself. So looking just at the four-legged meat issue, Coger did not say that any time there is a colloquy, there is an imposition of the religiously required test or clergy verification test, that is automatically a substantial burden on a prisoner's practice. What Coger said is a substantial burden is one that makes an inmate's practice effectively impracticable. And that was the case in Coger, as a matter of fact, because there the inmate's belief was he could not eat any meat or food that touched meat. Given that belief, the fact that he couldn't get a clergy verification and it wasn't required by his religion meant he couldn't get the vegan diet, which meant he couldn't practice his belief. The difference here is Mr. Nelson could still practice his belief with the regular diet. He just had the mere inconvenience of eating around the beef.
Well, if let's say the prison serves spaghetti and meat sauce with beef mixed in, Nelson would have had to skip the whole meal, if that was the meal, spaghetti with meat sauce.
No, Your Honor.
That's really impractical, trying to strain out the meat.
It is difficult, Your Honor. I agree. But first of all, he wouldn't have to skip the whole meal, because when spaghetti with meat sauce was served, other items would be served as well. It wouldn't just be spaghetti and meat sauce on his tray. And secondly, he didn't meet his burden of proving how often the meat was mixed with other food, how often beef was served, how difficult it was for him to eat around beef. In fact, his testimony and the dietitian's testimony and the master menu that were admitted into evidence show that beef was not served on a regular basis. It was an occasional item. And the dietitian testified that eating around the beef, he could still get a nutritious meal from the regular diet. So this case
but
is...
But he also testified that eating around all meat would not be a nutritious diet.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And so the claim being limited to the four-legged animal meat, which in our system is only beef.
So the prisoner's got to be have a pretty good eye for what that thing on his tray is, I guess, to know whether it's beef or perhaps some other form of meat.
There was no testimony that it was difficult for him to differentiate.
Probably all looks the same.
Between the beef and the turkey or chicken or fish that was also served, which he said he could eat during this time.
I can't recall, was there pork in the diet?
No. Pork is not served. This case really is more like the Kaufman case than Coger. In Kaufman, this court stated that, you know, prison officials were wrong to deny an atheist study group on the ground that it was not religious. That was wrong. But the fact is, the inmate's religious practice was not burdened by the denial of a study group. By the same token here, Chaplain Miller may have been mistaken in denying the diet on the ground that it was not religiously based. But the fact is, at the end of the day, Mr. Nelson was still able to practice his religion while getting the regular diet. And so the district court did not clearly err. It's not implausible that Mr. Nelson's practice was not substantially burdened. And finally, just to touch on the Establishment Clause.
If I could stop you, just before you go to your final point on ERIFRA, doesn't Mr. Nelson have a claim against Chaplain Miller, a damage claim under ERIFRA, as a supplemental claim to his federal claim?
Yes. However, his official capacity claim under the Illinois RFRA is barred by sovereign immunity.
Right,
he has an individual capacity claim, which would fall under the same analysis because there was no substantial burden. So the analysis in terms of looking at the merits here all turns on the lack of a substantial burden. And so that's why the state claim fails as well.
Sorry for the interruption.
No. and finally, about the Establishment Clause violation, Chaplain Miller permissively differentiated between a past practice of granting the vegan diet to Muslim and African Hebrew Israelite prisoners and the novel request that Mr. Nelson was presenting. As the court's discussion with Mr. Mills showed, this is it's a difficult question to determine when a dietary request is religiously based and when it's simply a prisoner's preference or an attempt to manipulate the system. There is a cost to providing exceptions in the diet. Even though there is a vegan diet plan, it still requires looking into the request, trying to understand, is this sincere? Is this religiously based? And ultimately, we agree it was. But the fact that Chaplain Miller may have been wrong in his assessment doesn't mean that he was inequitably applying the criteria. He still was attempting to apply what he thought was the proper criteria equally to all religions. And he stated this in his testimony at 127 of the transcript. He says, "I applied the same test for everybody." So it was not an Establishment Clause violation because he knew from past practice that these established religions had needed a vegan diet as part of their practice. But he needed to inquire further with respect to Mr. Nelson. Unless the court has further questions?
Apparently not.
We ask you to affirm, as stated here and in our briefs.
Thank you, Ms. Murphy. Mr. Mills.
You start with mootness. They say this is in process, but there are several levels of regulations, and there is a process to go through, but they haven't actually started any of it. There are institutional directives. That's the one Chaplain Miller relied on. Those can be changed at the whim of the warden. There's no process that has to go through at all. The warden can simply change them. He has not. There are administrative directives, which apply statewide, do not have the force of law, but do govern the way prison officials act. Again, those do not require going through the public hearings, et cetera, that formal regulations do. Those can be changed at the direction of the director. He has not changed those. Then finally, there are the formal administrative regulations, which do have to go through a public hearing process. They have to be submitted to the public for comment period. If there are objections, they have to hold a public hearing, and then it has to be submitted to the JCAR, the legislative body, for approval. They haven't started that process. There's been no notice to the public that there are going to be new regulations. So maybe they're in process back in somebody's mind. Maybe somebody's drafted them, but Kodger is now a year old and RLUIPA is now 10 years old, and they still haven't changed the regulations and they have not changed the things they could do at the wave of their hands. So to say that the regulations are in the process suggests that right now it's not moot yet because they haven't changed those things they could change. And again, the burden is on them to say that there's not a likelihood of success, of repetition of this conduct, particularly in light of the chaplain's testimony that says, even today, I don't think he should have the diet.
What was the date of his testimony, Mr. Mills?
It would have been in January of 2008, roughly a year ago.
So we have a year of compliance at this point.
Yes, but again, mandated compliance, and this case is still pending. There's no evidence in the record whatsoever that would suggest that if this case were dismissed and ended, that he wouldn't lose the diet the next day.
But and the position he took was before Kodger came down.
Yes, it was. That's correct. But again, they had...
And that case had significant impact on this issue.
Well, I would have thought so, but again, they haven't changed the regulations and they haven't come in here with an affidavit or any other evidence like they did in the Sosman case that they did give you, saying that we've changed these rules. All you have is an argument by counsel. You have nothing from the Department of Corrections, nothing from the defendant saying I've changed. That they could have presented that evidence, and that's exactly what happened in the Sosman case that they gave you last week. In that case, the director of the department came in and said, we've changed the rules. This is moot because we agree it's wrong. We've changed the rules. They didn't present that kind of evidence here. If they had, it'd be a different story.
What regulations specifically would have to be directed to be locked in by injunctive relief?
I don't have the citation, but it's the one that this court discussed in Kodger, the one that requires that there be that it be a requirement of religion and that they get verification from an outside source that it is a requirement of the religion. So cited in the brief, I don't remember off the top of my head. And as I say, that is reiterated, and that's not what Chaplain Miller relied on. He says the regulations are irrelevant. What he follows is the institutional directive at TAMS, and that's something the warden can change every day, any day, without any process at all. All the warden has to do is rewrite it, or presumably his lawyers.
The warden, if you know, at an institution like TAMS, which is somewhat unique in the system, have authority separate from the warden's authority in lesser institutions?
No. Each prison in the system has its own institutional directives, which are the ones that the staff in that prison look at in order to determine their day-to-day activities. And those are all issued under the signature of and by the authority of the warden. Now, I assume they have lawyers who actually do the drafting, not the warden sits there and drafts them, but it doesn't have to go through any administrative process. It's unique to that prison, and that prison controls what its own directives say. So that could have been changed any time. They could have come in with an affidavit from the warden saying, we've changed the institutional directives. They did not. I thought Your Honor asked a very good question about 1983. Our contention is, quite aside from all this contract analogies, which I think only apply because of sovereign immunity. Obviously, Chaplain Miller in his individual capacity does not have sovereign immunity. He may not be bound by contract, but if he's not, then Section 1983 provides a damages claim against him for violating RLUIPA. Once RLUIPA is constitutional under the Commerce Clause, then everybody has to follow it. All state employees have to follow it, not because they're bound by contract, but because of the sovereignty clause of the Constitution, which is the supremacy clause, which says they have to follow federal law. So if they don't, then Section 1983 provides a remedy if RLUIPA doesn't provide a direct remedy. Substantial burden. Our contention is that the district court did not make a factual finding. Its factual findings are right. Well, I think their factual findings had a problem, but I think that it was the legal standard that they applied that was wrong. He continued to insist that the question was whether there was a substantial burden on his diet, on his nutrition, not whether or not there was a substantial burden on his exercise of religion. It may be true that you can survive not eating the four-legged animals, but that doesn't mean there's not a burden. And I use the analogy of being required to carry around a five-pound weight if you're a Catholic and not any other religion. Clearly, you can survive that. It wouldn't kill anybody, but it would certainly be a disincentive.
Can I ask you just a second? I know our time has expired, but and I'll give you an opportunity to wrap up, Mr. Mills. On the 1983 issue, would we need, in light of the what proceeded below, to remand on the issue of qualified immunity?
I don't think so. I think that this Court has made it long clear, and the Supreme Court has made it long clear, that when a prisoner has a sincere belief in a diet, it has to be granted. I think that the only issue for remand would be the issue of damages, the quantity of damages.
Did you want to? I interrupted you if you had a concluding.
That's fine, Your Honor. I will end there. My time, my red light is on. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. Thank you again, Ms. Murphy. The case is taken under advisement.